Do you believe it? Jesus says all of this stuff to Martha, and then he just looks at her and he goes, well, do you actually believe this? Right? And there's the kicker, isn't it, really? Like, do you actually believe it? You know, like, do you? Right? Do you believe this? And do you believe it not just in the sense of it being some cool doctrine? Do you actually believe it could happen? Do you actually believe that it is happening? Do you even think it's actually really possible? Right? Practically. Like, realistically, practically. Right? Because here's the thing. If it is actually happening, and you can't believe that it is, not only is that going to mean you'll be unnecessarily sad and frightened, it's actually going to be a real hindrance to you being able to be part of it happening. Right? So some of you might have heard of the great English writer G.K. Chesterton. Right? Chesterton's a personal favorite of mine. I named my son after him, Chess. And he once made this astonishing statement. Christendom has had a series of revolutions, and in each one of them, Christianity has died. Christianity has died many times and risen again. For it had a God who knew the way out of the grave. Next one. It is so true that three or four times at least in the history of Christendom, the whole soul seemed to have gone out of Christianity, and almost every man in his heart expected its end. So when Christianity rose again, suddenly, and through them, it was almost as unexpected as Christ rising from the dead. Right? We can even be more specific about how this process of the church dying and rising again actually takes place. There's a theologian called Elaine Heath, and she wrote a fascinating book called The Mystic Way of Evangelism. That is the last phrases that you would put together, isn't it? The Mystic Way of Evangelism. But here we go. Right, next slide. She says this, the history of God's people is a history of life cycles. Right? A history of clarity about call and identity, followed by complacence, followed by collusion with powers, followed by catastrophic loss. Contrary to being a disaster, the exilic experiences of loss and marginalization are what are needed to restore the church to its evangelistic place. On the margins of society, the church, next slide, yep, the church will once again find its God-given voice to speak to the dominant culture in subversive ways, resisting the powers and principalities, standing against the seduction of the status quo. Isn't that a fascinating little thing? I want you to hear the cycle of C words she has here. Clarity. Clarity. We know what we're meant to do because we have call. Complacence. Because now everything's going so great, we don't have to work so hard. This is great. Which leads to you letting other people do your job for you, which is collusion. And that collusion eventually leads to catastrophe, but it's a cycle. So what will happen is you'll get to the catastrophic phase, and then out of that, God will call again. And out of that call will become clarity. And then it all starts again, you see? Right? Now, what's another word for catastrophe? Death. The church seemingly, for all intents and purposes, dies. Other groups, rise up around us, and they look so much fresher, so much smarter, so much stronger, so much cooler. And how do we feel? We feel intimidated. We feel old. We feel tired. We feel outdated. And it looks like they'll beat us. And then we'll die. That's what the preacher in the Jesus Revolution was feeling. He was feeling old and tired, like he was like his church was about to die. And we can feel like that until we don't. Because call comes. I'm the church historian at Table. That's kind of my main gig. I teach in other things, but like one of the interesting things is I've been teaching about this cycle for over a decade. Right? And I got to say, historically, the proof is in the pudding. So, right, the early church, next slide, was born, of course, into the Roman Empire. And at the time, you got to remember, the empire was fresh and new. It had only actually had emperors for about 30 years before Jesus came. Okay? And of course, across the empire, there were all these massive temples to the traditional Greco-Roman gods, like, you know, your Zeus, your Apollo, and your Athena. And they were so strong. Like, the money, the sheer wealth and power of that religious system, the wealth and power of the Roman emperor, right? If you were in, I don't know, like 50 AD, and you were putting money on who's going to win out of that religious system, long established, full of cash, full of power, got everyone on board, and little bitty Christianity, none of you would take those odds for Christianity. Right? So Christianity should have been stamped out by that whole thing. And the Roman emperors gave it a really good go at stamping it out until we converted them. Right? And then this happened. Constantine. Next one. Yeah, there we go. Right? And once Constantine's converted, in virtually no time at all, the entire Roman Empire became Christian. To the point where, consciously in society, the idea of the Roman Empire and Christianity was so enmeshed that effectively no one could believe that one could survive without the other, which was a problem when the Roman Empire was destroyed by barbarians, because everyone now said, well, it's done. Christianity's done. The barbarians are going to kill off Christianity until we converted them. Right? And Europe became even more Christian than they'd been before. Well, until the next mob came in, the Vikings, right? Right? Oh, there's the destruction of Rome. Yep. Now the next one. Vikings. The Vikings come. And the Vikings invaded Europe from Scandinavia with their big, scary boats and their big, scary axes and their big, scary gods like Thor and Odin, and they literally slaughtered Christians everywhere they went. Now, I got to ask you a question. Have you been really scared by a Viking lately? Right? I can tell you, if you were in 900 AD, you flipping well were, because they looked so strong and so fresh with their big, strong, fresh gods. Well, and then we converted them too. Okay, right? So, right? Okay, the reality of Chesterton's point here is that just like Lazarus, Martha's brother, the church knows somebody who knows the way out of the grave. And this has happened again and again and again throughout history. I've been telling my students for years, because you know that whole thing of like, gee, Christianity's really doing it tough, isn't it? oh, look, a big, scary, like, this is starting to really be intimidating. I mean, that's been going on for years. I've had students freaking out about that and thinking that their church is going to close its doors for years, dude. And what I've been telling them over and over is just wait and see. Look at the evidence that I just showed you. Like, don't worry, things will turn around. It'll happen in our era too. Okay? Now, this is what I've come to realize more recently, is that it's already happening. It's gone for me, personally. It's gone from being a don't worry, this will turn out that way, to dude, it's already happening. Right? It's been happening in ways we didn't notice. It's happening all the time in ways it's right under our noses. It's like little mustard seeds that kind of pop up all over the garden and then all of a sudden become a massive tree. Hypothetically speaking, right? You know, like, it's that kind of a thing, right? Now, I want to stress, I don't want to minimize the significant challenges that we need to face as a church in the world around us. You know, it would be dangerous for us being able to overcome them if we underestimated them. But I think it is just as dangerous to overemphasize them, right, to the point where they seem insurmountable. That is the weirdest thing. I find this in certain circles all the time, is that, like, someone gets someone in to talk about, like, how the church needs to do more mission and evangelism or, like, help in the community or whatever, and, like, they say, the problem is so dire and so bad and we're all going to fail, so you got to get moving. Who of you wants to be motivated? Who of you is motivated by that kind of a thing? I just don't buy it. And it's even weirder when it's just evidently not true. Right? Like, yeah, things are tough. But God's doing all kinds of crazy stuff. Right? Let me say it again. We can start to think that these problems in our society are insurmountable for God. Are you flipping kidding me? Right? Insurmountable for God, the creator of the universe, the one who defeated death itself. They are not insurmountable for him. He knows the way out of the grave. He is the resurrection and the life. And anybody who believes in him will receive that resurrection and life. The question comes back, though. Next slide. Do you believe this? Next slide. Well, do you? Let me help make that easier for you. Okay, like, you know, it's handy if someone can help you believe something, right? Make it a little easier to believe. So let me help you out. Let's start dealing with the biggest issue I think I hear a lot about. And that is the idea that the churches decline in our nation, right? Statistically, we've seen a massive drop-off in people identifying as Christians in censuses, right? Both here and in the United States. Who's heard that, right? And so we can think about, wow, the church is in massive decline, right? However, a Christian social analyst and theologian, a guy called Ed Stetzer, right, which is the next slide, Ed Stetzer published some really interesting data about this in 2018, and it holds up to today. What he found was, in fact, that there was not a decline in people being Christians. There was a significant decline in people saying they were Christians. Okay? When you actually measure people by the kind of things that actually define them as Christian, right, like regular church attendance, regular prayer and Bible reading, you know, looking after the poor and stuff like that, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? When you measure that, as opposed to whether they're just ticking a box in a census, they haven't actually really declined that much at all. And I actually want you to think about this in terms of, say, the last 10 years. Think of your workplaces or your school or whatever. Do you think there's less people actually saying that they're Christian in your church or your workplace or your sporting club or whatever than there were? When you were there 10 years ago, there probably weren't that many. Right? That hasn't actually changed. Right? So it's not really accurate to say that there's been this massive decline. All that's happened is because of wider societal trends, people haven't felt the need, the obligation, or the benefits of pretending to be. They don't have to pretend that they're Christian anymore because it helps them get a job, or because their nonna told them to, or, you know, because I was, you know, I was baptized as a baby in a Baptist church, or whatever. Like, it's not, people don't need to pretend anymore. Now, we could lament that. We could lament that people don't have to pretend anymore. Frankly, I don't. Right? And we might lament that they're in the midst of that, in the midst of us losing our power over people to effectively intimidate them into pretending. Isn't that the weirdest thing to be upset about? Losing our power to make people pretend because we're intimidating them into it. Right? And look, there are other people now intimidating them to pretend that they believe stuff, aren't they? Right? Right? And it's kind of like, yeah, man, whatever. Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I'll say hi to that flag. Okay, whatever. Right, okay. Like, there's a lot of that going on. But if other people are intimidated by stuff, we should never be intimidated. More than that, historically, remember, the church has a tendency to complacency when things get too comfortable. Right? It's like a muscle. We grow stronger when it's stretched, when it's strained a bit. When things are too easy, we get into complacency, which leads to collusion, which leads to catastrophe. Think back to that picture of the preacher from Jesus Revolution, right? That's back in 1969. Now, obviously, somewhere before that, he's had his glory days as a pastor. Right? When was that, do you think? When was his great time where the church dictated, you know, a thriving culture? Like, you know, was really in, maybe it was the 50s. Okay, here's the, right? Your classic picture of the 50s church kind of group. Can you show the next slide? All right. Maybe it's this. Maybe that was the golden era for the church. Right? Maybe that's a bit too far back. Let's go with the 80s, okay? Maybe it's a 1980s church, like one of these ones, right? Maybe that was, right? Here's my question for you, and it was a question that was asked actually recently at the annual conference of my denomination, the Baptists here in SA. The speaker got up and he asked this question: are we in a better or a worse situation today than they were back then? Are we in a better or a worse situation? Now, my hunch is that your immediate reaction to that is, oh, we are so much worse. Right? We are so much worse because, like, look at them, like, look at it, you know, and look at those ties. Right? Okay, now, I think our immediate reaction is this kind of sad nostalgia. They don't make churches like that anymore, that kind of thing, right? Let's actually stop for a second. Let's actually quantify that for a minute. Okay, what are some measurements we could bring in? Here's the first one. Next slide. Our kids are way, way safer than they were in the 1980s or the 1950s. Our kids are way safer. We've got processes and practices in our Sunday schools and youth groups that protect our kids far more deliberately and robustly than they had back then. I can tell you that. Our kids, quantifiably, are way better off in our churches today. Musically, right? Musically, we have seen a massive rise in worship music throughout that time. And don't get me wrong, the 80s had some really good music, right? You know, red, yellow, blue book represent for all of the older people here. You know, I hear you, bro. Right? Okay? And like the old hymns, I love the old hymns and everything. Don't get me wrong. Right? And we can still all love those while at the same time celebrating the fact that we've got more songs and wonderful songs that have been written. Right? Which leads to the next one. Technologically, we are way better off than we were back then in the 80s. You know why? Because they didn't have the internet. Right? While we can lament the growth of certain aspects of the internet, there's bad things on the internet, there are tons of benefits for the internet, for the church. Right? We can listen to all that amazing worship music on Spotify and similar apps like that, right? And when you've got to the end of listening to cool worship music on Spotify, well, you just flip over to where there's amazing pastors and preachers and all that kind of stuff on the podcasts there, right? We've seen the rise of incredible Christian content on the internet. Like the next one, the Bible Project. I mean, dude, that's amazing stuff, right? Do you know they've got 4.31 million subscribers across the world? Some of their videos have over 7 million views. All right? Who's better off? Us or the 80s church? We're, like, they wouldn't comprehend the idea of something like Bible Project on YouTube would be beyond their comprehension. Right? Which leads to the next one, Bible access. Every one of us can read our Bible at the tap of a finger, right? Right. The YouVersion Bible app has 685 million subscribers across the world, right? And that's not just with Bibles in all manner of languages and versions, although that in itself is a miracle. Who's got it better off than, you know, in terms of Bible access? Us or the people in the 80s? Right? That's before you even notice that on these kind of Bible apps, there's devotional content that is, you know, is being eaten up by Christians, growing them in their faith every day, right? And there are tons of other devotional apps. I mean, I just picked out YouVersion, but there's tons of them empowering Christians in ways that 1980s Christians, they couldn't have dreamed of, right? Okay? There are so many languages that didn't have the scriptures back in the 80s that have it now. Which leads to my next point. We are far more multicultural than the... I mean, I don't want to go back to that picture. I want to stay on this one. But we could go back to that one, and you know what you notice about that one? How white it is. And look, don't get me wrong. That's fine. Except, isn't it wonderful that the sheer diversity that we have? Right? We have seen across that time the massive growth of the church across the world. But more than that, even if you went to the 80s and you knew that there were churches in Africa growing or whatever, you had no communication way of actually knowing any of them. Right? Now we are so much more aware of Christians from different cultures. Partially, again, that's because the internet has made it so that we can hear and learn more from them. Right? Learn what preachers from Africa and Asia are saying, be inspired by the Chinese underground church, like all kinds of stuff, right? But it's also because, hey, who needs to go and get stuff from the store? It's been home delivered, right? We've got, you know, the growth of the, you know, and like your own congregation is a testament to this, you know, your pastors are. Like, we've had, you know, the local church made more of a witness of when it says in Revelation 7, I saw people of every tribe, tongue, and nation. We live that every week in our churches now. Who's better off, us or them? The 80s or not? And look, I'm not saying that, you know, it's bad to have a monocultural society. I'm just saying, like, we benefit from all of the different cultural perspectives looking at the scriptures together. Right? Who's better off? Right, and then we can join with churches. We can have services with churches across the world thanks to live streaming. And we can stream into our own church's services a lot of the time if we can't be there in person. Lots of churches have streaming services now, right? I can tell you from Tabor's perspective, the internet has completely revolutionized how we can teach. Right? Students can access their textbooks from home anytime they want. They can watch lectures. They can join classes live from across the world. I had two students last semester. One lived in Qatar and the other one lived in Uganda. And they're live streaming in. And they're talking to me and other students in real time. You imagine that. Tell that to the guys in the 80s. Who's better off? We are so much better off. Now, here's the kicker. How have so many of these blessings come about? Well, if we think of the rise of internet resources for the church, when did they skyrocket? When did we get a massive improvement in that? I'll tell you when. During this. Next slide, the COVID pandemic. Now, the COVID pandemic was a horrible event. Newsflash, it really sucked. Okay? All right? But horrible events, horrible situations, that's kind of part of the process. You got to die to rise again. Streaming of services and all the other kind of things that I'm talking about rose directly because we were forced to start using them during COVID. Right? In fact, COVID, as terrible as it, you know, do you think the church is better off before COVID or after COVID? Quantifiably, we are way better off after COVID. COVID was awesome for the church. Tragic, horrible, would never want to go through it again. But COVID, quantifiably, was actually great for the church in a variety of ways. Okay, you're going to be like, you really got to sell this one well to us, okay? So here we go. Okay, right, here's a go. Like I said, so many churches have streaming services now where they're streaming out their services. Right? Well, they started to do that during COVID. And all of us started watching them. And we all watched them on things like Facebook and YouTube and you know, all that stuff, right? Well, here's the next thing. That made those actually really popular posts. Those streamed worship services were really popular. Okay? And algorithms on social media, part of the way they work is that they highlight to your friends when you're watching a popular post. That's how viral media works. So there's tons of people during the pandemic and they're stuck in their homes and they're bored. And it's Sunday morning and they're just scrolling their phones while all of these church services are going on. And many of those people would never have dreamed of setting foot into a church building. Why? Because they don't know when they're meant to sit up and stand up and like, do I sing now? And what, who sings? Like what? Like, you know, all that kind of thing, right? And they were and they knew what church was like. Church is a place where it's boring, and you just get told how much you suck, and it's guilt-ridden, and you're going to spend the whole time being bored and guilty. Okay, but. Here's the thing, if they could just take a peek at a church service on their laptop and no one knows, I might as well have a look, I suppose. Now everyone else is watching it, I wonder what's going on. And here's the thing, those people were amazed. This is a story the Anglican Church in Britain, they talk about this quite regularly. The amount of people who streamed into Anglican services, I mean, right, and were utterly astonished at what they saw. Right? Do you know that, like, the church, the internet in England, in the United Kingdom, broke down one Sunday morning because too many people were watching streamed worship services? It malfunctioned. Okay, now here's where I'm going with this. The thing is, you're all used to what church is like. to the point where familiarity breeds contempt. If you're actually a person who has never seen anything like the church before, it is amazing. Like, it really is. You have people, it's uplifting, it's full of hope, but it's hope while also being real, honest, compassionate. Right? You have people from across generations, across cultures, just hanging out. Where the hell do you find that anywhere else in the world? Like, where do you find that in our society? You don't. It's inspiring. Alpha, another one of the great blessings that they didn't have in the 80s or the 50s. Alpha, online alpha, skyrocketed in popularity during the pandemic. It was huge. Tons of people came to Christ. And that's before we even start to worry about things like, you know, the existential crisis of, hey, I might die of a horrific disease. Like, that wasn't even that much of a factor. It was just witnessing what the church can do. And for us who have been going to church for a long time, many of us have found ourselves stuck in churches where for years we just didn't really fit, right? But we were on the rosters, you know, so we couldn't leave. How many of you left your church during the pandemic and found yourself here? No, I won't get hands up. That's too much of a question, right? Here's the thing. I want you to realize there was a complete realignment of people across the Western world during this period. People had been like stuck in their churches and they didn't actually like that church, but they were on the roster and they couldn't get out of it because they had to be there next week until they didn't. Because COVID acted as a circuit breaker, so they didn't have to come to that church anymore. And that meant that they now had a permission, effectively, to move. But then they're like, well, where will we go now, honey? I don't know. Oh, look, there's all these streaming services. So everyone got to try before they bought, you know, try before you buy. So there was a massive realignment of people throughout that period going to new churches. And you know, we might go, oh, it's very bad to church shop and everything like that. Except what that meant was that there had been a tremendous inefficiency of Christians for a long, long time where people were in ministries and in churches doing ministries that they don't actually have a heart for, a calling for, or the gifts for. And suddenly they were able to find themselves in churches that allowed them to, it made them more spiritually efficient. If they wanted a social justice church and they'd been stuck in a church that never did social justice, suddenly they're there. If they were a church, they really longed for a church with a rich and vibrant liturgy, like, I don't know, the Catholics or the Orthodox or the Anglicans or something like that, now they could. If they wanted to go to a more charismatic church like the Vineyard, they could, right? And that actually made them worship God better, serve him better. It's better. We are so much better off after the pandemic. We had to die. You can't get resurrected if you don't die first. It's just part of the process. Right? To finish, I want to come back to the picture I started with. Okay? Right? Now, that's obviously the actor Kelsey Grammer. Right? But he's playing a real-life person. That person is Chuck Smith. Right. So next slide. That's him not long into this film. Not long after, the same guy with that worried look on his face of we're all doomed, he's here. Right? They go, our church building is too small. We'll set up a tent and hopefully we'll fill it within 6 months. They fill it in the first week. Okay? That actually happened. Like, this is based on a true story. That actually happened. It was called the Jesus Movement. Right? Next slide. Okay? Right? It actually happened. Like, in 1969, all these hippies actually became Christians. It was huge. Right? And his denomination grew, and it grew, and it grew, and it grew, until in 1977, one of his churches hired a guy, and the guy's name was John Wimber. Next slide. That's John Wimber. And in 1982, Chuck Smith and John Wimber realized things were getting so explosive and so vibrant and so huge out of the ministries that was going on there that they said, listen, John, you got to go off and you got to start your own denomination, man. This is God's doing something in you and in your crew. You got to go. You got to start something new. And they started it. And you know what it was called? The Vineyard. Right? Okay? Next one. Right? And here we are. You are direct descendants of that worried little pastor in that tiny little church. Doesn't that just blow your mind? And there is no way that the Chuck Smith in that first picture could have imagined that he could have imagined this. A global movement. He thought the church was dying. But it knew somebody who knows the way out of the grave. It knew somebody who said, who is still alive and saying, I am the resurrection and the life. Do you believe it? You can believe it. Thanks.
Angus, can you sing the last song? Just one song, the last song that you sing. I will share something in between the song, and we're going to take communion. We were going to scrape the communion, but last minute I felt the Lord saying, do communion, and we're going to do communion. But we're going to do it differently. I think the question today for us all is, do you believe in Jesus Christ? So we're going to remember Christ, remember his life and resurrection, and I'll give you some instruction how to take the communion, all right? But the whole thing is, when you take the communion, you just check your own heart, how much you believe in Christ, in his resurrection power. All right, let's be upstanding and let's sing together.